From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Some nations may be able to turn a blind eye to atrocities in other countries. The United States of America is different. And as president, I refuse to wait for the images of slaughter and mass graves before taking action.
As President Obama defends the U.S.-led attack on Libya as humanitarian, what about his response to other U.S. allies violently cracking down on pro-democracy movements? We host a debate on U.S. intervention. In Syria, almost 300 protesters have been detained, including an Egyptian-American engineer named Mohammed Radwan, who's accused of spying for Israel. His family adamantly denies the charges. Radwan spoke to Democracy Now! When he was in Egypt last month.
I lived in the States, and, you know, there's a lot of political awareness since 2001 or 2002 when the war started and everything. Back then, before pre-2001, there wasn't too much thought about the political, anyone's political identity. Well, here people are always politically aware, they always have a political opinion, but everyone was so jaded. And seeing this, all of a sudden everyone is politically charged, everyone's got an opinion, everyone wants to see change.
We'll go to Washington, D.C. for an update from Radwan's brother on his efforts to secure U.S. assistance in gaining his release. Then the U.S. Supreme Court refuses to hear the appeal of Georgia death row prisoner Troy Davis, clearing the way for his execution. Okay. We'll speak to Troy Davis's sister, Martina Correa, about what's next for her brother. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a nationally televised address Monday night, President Obama defended his decision to authorize the U.S.-led attack on Libya. Obama said the United States has a humanitarian duty to prevent atrocities overseas.
We have intervened to stop a massacre, and we will work with our allies and partners to maintain the safety of civilians. We will deny the regime arms, cut off its supplies of cash, assist the opposition, and work with other nations to hasten the day when Gaddafi leaves power. It may not happen overnight, as a badly weakened Gaddafi tries desperately to hang on to power. But it should be clear to those around Gaddafi and to every Libyan that history is not on Gaddafi's side.
While President Obama claims the military mission is narrowly focused on saving lives, he did not mention that the U.S. airstrikes have been strategically targeted to aid the Libyan rebels in their fight against forces loyal to Gaddafi. On Monday, senior U.S. military officials admitted the Libyan rebels could be quickly overrun if the airstrikes cease. This is Navy Vice Admiral Bill Gortney, director of the U.S. military's Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Clearly, the opposition is not well organized, and it is not a very robust organization. I mean, that's obvious. So any gain that they make is tenuous based on that. I mean, it's clearly they're achieving a benefit from the actions that we're taking. We're not coordinated with it, but I think General Hamm's assessment is pretty good.
Earlier today in London, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton met with the political leader of Libya's rebel movement, Mahmoud Jibril. It marked their second meeting in a little more than a week. Meanwhile, the Obama administration's announced plans to send a special envoy for Libya to Benghazi within the next week for talks with rebel opposition leaders. Japanese authorities have reported a number of new setbacks at the crippled Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant. Plutonium has been found in the soil near the plant, providing new evidence that the fuel rods in at least one of the plant's reactors had experienced a partial meltdown. Meanwhile, workers are scrambling to stop a new leak of highly contaminated water from reaching the ocean near the nuclear plant. The Institute for Energy and Environmental Research has released data showing the radiation leak in Japan is far worse than the one at Three Mile Island in 1979. Researchers estimate the Japanese plant has released 160,000 times as much radioactive iodine-131 as the Three Mile Island accident. The researchers said the radiation leak in Chernobyl was 10 times larger than the leak so far in Japan. Japanese Prime Minister Naoto Kan said today his government remains in a state of maximum alert. The Japanese government is now considering nationalizing Tokyo Electric Power, the owner of the nuclear plant. Mounting costs and public anger are threatening the future of the company, the largest power utility in Japan and Asia. The U.S. Army has issued another apology to the people of Afghanistan after Rolling Stone magazine published more photos of U.S. troops posing with the corpses of Afghan civilians. Similar photos appeared last week in the German magazine Der Spiegel. We also ran them on Democracy Now! The Pentagon says, quote, "The photos published by Rolling Stone are disturbing and in striking contrast to the standards and values of the United States Army." The photos include images of a group of U.S. Army soldiers accused of killing unarmed Afghan civilians in cold blood. Rolling Stone also published a graphic video of U.S. soldiers shooting and killing two Afghans on a motorcycle. The video was taken on patrol with a helmet-mounted camera. Soldiers later shared the video with others in clear violation of Army standards. The Pakistani government has vowed to compensate the families of 39 civilians who died in a U.S. drone strike in North Waziristan on March 17th. Each family will receive approximately $3,500. It's believed to be the first time Pakistan has offered compensation to the victims of a U.S. drone strike. Sarah Holwinski of the Campaign for Innocent Victims in Conflict said, quote, "Drone victims have been all but ignored. Before this pledge of compensation, civilian victims received nothing for their losses." Former State Department spokesperson P.J. Crowley told the BBC Monday he had no regrets over his comments criticizing the military's treatment of accused Army whistleblower Bradley Manning, even though the comments led to his ouster.
I thought that the treatment of Bradley Manning, the fact that he had to sleep naked and stand in a jail cell naked, was counterproductive to our broader effort of appropriately prosecuting someone who has violated his oath of office.
P.J. Crowley resigned earlier this month after accusing the Pentagon of being, quote, "ridiculous and counterproductive and stupid" in its treatment of Bradley Manning. Egypt's Supreme Council of the Armed Forces has revealed ousted President Hosni Mubarak and his family are under house arrest in Egypt. The announcement was made after rumors emerged suggesting Mubarak had fled to Saudi Arabia. In the Ivory Coast, forces loyal to UN-backed President-elect Alassane Ouattara have attacked the town of Daloa as the country moves closer to an all-out civil war following last year's disputed elections. The city of Daloa is strategically important because it's located in the heart of Ivory Coast's Coca Belt. Independent Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is criticizing Republican efforts to cut social spending at a time when many of the nation's largest corporations are paying nothing or almost nothing in federal income tax. Sanders has released a list of the 10 worst corporate income tax avoiders. Companies include ExxonMobil, Bank of America, General Electric, Chevron, Boeing, Valero Energy, Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, ConocoPhillips, and Carnival Cruise Lines. In the case of General Electric, the company has made $26 billion in profits in the United States over the past 5 years. During that time, it's received over $4 billion in tax refunds from the IRS. Michigan Republican Governor Rick Snyder has signed a law to cut off benefits for unemployed workers after 20 weeks. While Michigan has maintained an unemployment level of over 10% longer than any other state, it will soon pay fewer weeks of unemployment benefits than any other state. Other states around the country are considering similar legislation. Florida Republicans are seeking to cut unemployment benefits to 20 weeks as well. Some analysts suggest the number could drop to as low as 12 weeks if state unemployment falls to 5% or less. Meanwhile, in Arkansas, the state Senate has signed into law a bill reducing state-paid benefits by 1 week while tightening eligibility. Indiana has also tightened eligibility for unemployment benefits and has capped weekly payments at $390. Democratic lawmakers from Indiana have returned to the state after fleeing 5 weeks ago in an attempt to derail a Republican effort to pass anti-union legislation. Democratic House members said they returned after Republicans made a number of concessions, including withdrawing a measure that would have made Indiana a right-to-work state, meaning no workplace could require employees to join a union or pay union dues. In Wisconsin, a dispute over whether the state's new union-busting law has gone into effect will be the focus of a hearing today before a Dane County Circuit judge. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker's administration has already begun enforcing the law that strips the rights of most public employees to collectively bargain. The state is no longer collecting dues on behalf of state unions, and public employees are now being charged more for their pensions and health care. Meanwhile, some local governments are not implementing the new law for their employees. In other labor news, Republican Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina has said he hopes to see all federal employees lose the right to collectively bargain. He made the comments in an interview with the website thinkprogress.org.
Senator, would you like to see some of these bills that we see at a state level curbing the collective bargaining rights of public employees' unions? Would you like to see those on a federal level?
Well, I don't believe collective bargaining has any place in government.
Including at a federal level? Or?
Including at the federal level. That's what elections are, collective bargaining, for people bargaining. In fact, I think it just doesn't make sense when we're elected as representatives to determine the fiscal condition of the government than to have an unelected third party bargaining at the table with monopoly power. It just doesn't make any sense.
Attorneys for Walmart are heading to the Supreme Court today to urge justices to block a group of past and current female workers from filing a massive class-action sex discrimination lawsuit against the retail giant. The justices will decide whether the small group of women who began the case 10 years ago can represent a huge nationwide class that may include millions of current and former employees who accuse the world's largest retailer of discrimination. In other legal news, the Supreme Court has dismissed the appeal of Georgia death row prisoner Troy Davis, whose case has been taken by death penalty opponents across the globe. Davis was convicted for the 1989 killing of an off-duty white police officer. Since then, 7 of the 9 non-police witnesses have recanted their testimony. There's no physical evidence tying Davis to the crime scene. We'll have more on Troy Davis' ruling later in the show. We'll speak with his sister in Savannah, Georgia. In business news, Sprint Nextel, the nation's third-largest cell phone provider, is urging regulators to block AT&T's purchase of T-Mobile. Sprint is claiming the acquisition would harm consumers and reduce competition. Meanwhile, the AT&T-T-Mobile merger has received the support of several prominent unions and civil rights organizations, including the AFL-CIO, the Communication Workers of America, and the NAACP. And 5 anti-nuclear Plowshares activists were sentenced Monday to prison for entering the Kitsap-Bangor naval base in Washington state to symbolically disarm the nuclear weapons stored there. The activists, who include 2 Catholic priests and a nun, were given varying sentences ranging up to 15 months in prison plus 1 year supervised release. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Obama's defended the U.S.-led attack on Libya with an appeal to what he called the national interest and a humanitarian duty to prevent atrocities overseas. In his first major address since ordering the bombing of Libya earlier this month, Obama cited Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi's repeated human rights violations, an international consensus for interventions, the revolution sweeping the Middle East and North Africa, and the threat of a massacre in the Libyan rebel stronghold of Benghazi. Obama also announced NATO will assume control of the attacks on Libya starting Wednesday.
In just 1 month, the United States has worked with our international partners to mobilize a broad coalition, secure an international mandate to protect civilians, stop an advancing army, prevent a massacre, and establish a no-fly zone with our allies and partners. To lend some perspective on how rapidly this military and diplomatic response came together, when people were being brutalized in Bosnia in the 1990s, it took the international community more than a year to intervene with air power to protect civilians. It took us 31 days. Moreover, we've accomplished these objectives consistent with the pledge that I made to the American people at the outset of our military operations. I said that America's role would be limited, and that we would not put ground troops into Libya, that we would focus our unique capabilities on the front end of the operation, and that we would transfer responsibility to our allies and partners. Tonight, we are fulfilling that pledge. Our most effective alliance, NATO, has taken command of the enforcement of the arms embargo and the no-fly zone. Last night, NATO decided to take on the additional responsibility of protecting Libyan civilians. This transfer from the United States to NATO will take place on Wednesday. Going forward, the lead in enforcing the no-fly zone and protecting civilians on the ground will transition to our allies and partners, and I am fully confident that our coalition will keep the pressure on Gaddafi's remaining forces.
Despite President Obama's touting of NATO's role, it's unclear how significant the transfer will be since the U.S. is the dominant member of the military alliance. In his remarks, President Obama also invoked an expansive rationale for foreign intervention, saying the U.S. acted to prevent a massacre in Libya.
That America cannot use our military wherever repression occurs. And given the costs and risks of intervention, we must always measure our interests against the need for action. But that cannot be an argument for never acting on behalf of what's right. In this particular country, Libya, at this particular moment, we were faced with the prospect of violence on a horrific scale. We had a unique ability to stop that violence, an international mandate for action, a broad coalition prepared to join us, the support of Arab countries, and a plea for help from the Libyan people themselves. We also had the ability to stop Gaddafi's forces in their tracks without putting American troops on the ground. To brush aside America's responsibility as a leader, and more profoundly, our responsibilities to our fellow human beings under such circumstances, would have been a betrayal of who we are. Some nations may be able to turn a blind eye to atrocities in other countries. The United States of America is different. And as president, I refuse to wait for the images of slaughter and mass graves before taking action. We have intervened to stop a massacre, and we will work with our allies and partners to maintain the safety of civilians. We will deny the regime arms, cut off its supplies of cash, assist the opposition, and work with other nations to hasten the day when Gaddafi leaves power. It may not happen overnight, as a badly weakened Gaddafi tries desperately to hang on to power. But it should be clear to those around Gaddafi and to every Libyan that history is not on Gaddafi's side. With the time and space that we have provided for the Libyan people, they will be able to determine their own destiny. And that is how it should be.
President Obama spoke as Libyan rebels continued to advance against the Gaddafi regime. The U.S.-led strikes have helped the rebels retake several cities and towns. The rebels and Gaddafi forces are now in an intense clash for Gaddafi's hometown of Sirte. The fighting in Libya also comes amidst a wave of political upheaval across the Middle East and North Africa. But while a number of governments have committed violence against protesters, the Obama administration's response has varied widely. The U.S. has sharply condemned Syria, where state forces continue a brutal crackdown on demonstrators in the city of Dara. On Monday, Syrian forces fired tear gas and live ammunition into a crowd of hundreds, dispersing a large rally. More than 60 people have died since protests erupted in Dara 10 days ago. Meanwhile, in Yemen, the White House continues to tacitly support President Ali Abdullah Saleh, despite the deaths of dozens of people and the uprising against his over 30-year rule. The U.S. has also backed the Bahraini monarchy's crackdown on an uprising that has killed around 20 people and injured dozens more. The response was the same in Egypt and Tunisia, where the U.S. backed two longtime presidents until popular protests forced them out of office. We're going to go to a break, and then when we come back, we'll have a debate on U.S. intervention. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. To discuss Libya and the latest developments across the Middle East and North Africa, we're joined by two guests. Vijay Prashad is Chair in South Asian History and Professor of International Studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, author of 11 books, most recently The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World. He opposes the U.S.-led intervention in Libya. And we're joined by Juan Cole, Professor of History at the University of Michigan. His blog and forum comment is online at juancole.com. His most recent book is called Engaging the Muslim World. Professor Cole, you support the U.S.-led intervention in Libya. You wrote about it in a piece called An Open Letter to the Left on Libya. Professor Cole is joining us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Lay out your argument for intervention, Professor Cole.
Well, intervention is always a problematic thing, and it could go badly wrong, I have to admit, from the outset. But you had a situation in Libya which was pretty peculiar. The uprising was a popular uprising. You had crowds coming out into the streets in downtowns, in Zawiya, in Zuwara, in so many of the cities of that country. In Benghazi, you had very substantial numbers of the officer corps defecting to the crowds, declaring for them. And it was chaotic, and it was not well coordinated, but it was nationwide. And I would estimate that at its height, the people had thrown off Gaddafi's rule in something on the order of 80% to 90% of the country. And mostly, it was done nonviolently. And then the Gaddafi sons, who command these special forces, and the tank commanders, made an attempt to put this down. And they did it in the most brutal way possible. They mounted tanks, 30, 40, 50 tanks, sent them into the downtowns of places like Zawiya, and they just shelled civilian crowds, protesters. They shelled buildings. They brutalized people over days until they scared everybody and put them down. And then they sent secret police around to round up alleged ringleaders and reestablish secret police rule. And they did this in town after town after town, and then they started rolling the tanks to the east, and they were on the verge of taking the rebel stronghold, Benghazi. And there certainly would have been a massacre there in the same way that there was in Zawiya if it hadn't been stopped at the last moment by United Nations allies. And here we had a situation where the Arab League met and demanded a no-fly zone. The U.S. Senate voted a resolution for a no-fly zone. The United Nations Security Council passed a resolution, 1973, asking not only for a no-fly zone, but for all measures necessary to protect civilian life. And now you have NATO and Arab League members like Qatar and the UAE patrolling Libya's skies, intervening against those tanks that were wreaking that havoc on ordinary people. So this is not something that could have been done in most situations. I mean, you were bringing up places like Yemen. Bombing Yemen would produce no result whatsoever, and I don't think anybody has asked for Yemen to be bombed. But in Libya, it made a difference. It saved Benghazi. It saved this popular protest movement, which, by the way, includes so many workers and ordinary people. Some of the cities which have thrown off Gaddafi, like Misrata, were known, for instance, for their steel mill. These are progressive forces who were fighting a wretched secret police regime.
We're also joined by Vijay Prashad. You are opposed to the intervention. Why?
Well, it's a long story, and it should go back to a particular kind of understanding of Libyan history, where Libya, from the Ottoman period, has had a divide between the East and the West. Certainly, Gaddafi, since the 1980s, has been a reactionary leader in Libya, and I have never, ever felt, and I've written from the 80s onward, that Gaddafi is on the side of reaction rather than a progressive. So let there be no mistake that what I would like to suggest is not a defense of Gaddafi by any means. On the other hand, there has been a protest movement in the East, as I said, that goes back several decades. Most recently, on February 17th, 2006, there was an uprising in Benghazi. It was put down. And then the anniversary came on February 17th of this year. There was an attempt to revive the protest, taking inspiration from other parts of North Africa and the Gulf. So, yes, indeed, there was a popular uprising. It was stronger in the East than in the West, although in working-class areas in Tripoli, there was some sporadic rising that was observed in Tajura and other neighborhoods. So that is correct. But very quickly, the French and the United States government came in and attempted to, I think, transform the Arab Spring to their advantage. So, for instance, when we talk about the rebel leadership in Benghazi, one should keep in mind that the two principal military leaders, one of whom was a former interior minister in the Gaddafi regime, and the second gentleman was a general who led troops in Chad in the 1980s and was then taken up with the Libyan National Salvation Front, went off to live in Vienna, Virginia for 30 years, about a 10-minute drive from Langley, and returned to Benghazi to, in a sense, I think, hijack the rebellion on behalf of the forces of reaction. It's very important to recognize, as Juan said quite correctly, that it's Qatar and the UAE and the Gulf, the GCC, the Gulf, what is it, Coordination Council, that is behind this, which is the principal Arab support for the humanitarian intervention, as it were. And these are the same places where the same organization which has attempted and has then now put down the uprising in Bahrain. You had the Saudi prince Faisal al-Turki talking about the GCC becoming perhaps a NATO of the Gulf region. So I would like to suggest that, you know, even by February 26th, 27th, when the United Nations first took up the Libyan case,
the rebellion was not quite a rebel army as it was in Tahrir Square. It had already been substantially co-opted by the people who were on behalf of NATO and the United States. So the first thing I would say is we should be very careful when we think of the rebels. We should not confuse all the rebellions across the Arab world and consider them all to be the same. There are some important differences. And secondly, the United States and NATO has its own agenda here. And when one supports an intervention, I think one should be very careful to see whose intervention we are supporting. Is this on behalf of those young people, the workers and others with whom we have allegiances and alliances? Is it going to be on their behalf, or is it going to be on behalf of people like Khalifa Haftar, the colonel who has returned from Vienna, Virginia, to lead the troops in Benghazi? So I would just like to say that my sense of dismay at this intervention is precisely because I think it's for the bad side of history, and in some ways it is a measure to clamp down on the Arab Spring, to take attention away as well from Bahrain and other places, rather than a part of the Arab Spring.
Professor Juan Cole, your response.
Well, I just think it's a mistake to characterize a mass movement of millions of people with reference to one or two individuals. And it's simply not the case that this was primarily, or that is to say only, an Eastern uprising. The city of Zawara, which is about the farthest west you can get among major population centers, threw off Gaddafi. Zawiya, which is in the west, threw off Gaddafi. Zintan, a major tribal center of the Zintan tribe, threw off Gaddafi, and Gaddafi's tanks are still trying to take it back. And Misrata, which is a western city of a major western city of nearly 600,000, threw off Gaddafi. So the east-west divide is a non-starter here. The West also didn't want Gaddafi. I would suggest that much of Tripoli didn't want him, and especially the working class districts, Souk al-Jumu'ah and others, as was mentioned. So this was a very widely based, geographically and class-wise, widely based uprising. That there are one or two individuals that you can name who came back to Benghazi and declared themselves leaders is irrelevant. We don't know what the leadership will look like going forward. There are also, allegations that some of the fighters had fought U.S. troops in Iraq and are, quote-unquote, al-Qaeda. There's this tendency to try to take one or two individuals and use them as a proxy to stereotype this uprising. You know, it's just the youth of Libya. It's the youth of Benghazi and often city notables and workers' unions and so forth. It's just the people. And you're going to have all kinds of people there, and some of them are criminals, and some of them might have a terrorist past, and some of them might be hooked up with the CIA. I don't know. But you can't use that as a stereotype for the whole movement and say, therefore, it's all right if these people are massacred with tank and artillery shells as they stand peacefully in the center of a city square like that of Benghazi.
I wanted to turn to a clip of President Obama last night and some of his most detailed comments on the Middle East and North Africa uprisings to date. Obama said the U.S. is broadly supportive of the protesters' demands.
10 days ago, having tried to end the violence without using force, the international community offered Gaddafi a final chance to stop his campaign of killing or face the consequences. Rather than stand down, his forces continued their advance, bearing down on the city of Benghazi, home to nearly 700,000 men, women, and children who sought their freedom from fear. At this point, the United States and the world faced a choice. Gaddafi declared he would show no mercy to his own people. He compared them to rats and threatened to go door to door to inflict punishment. In the past, we had seen him hang civilians in the streets and kill over 1,000 people in a single day. Now we saw regime forces on the outskirts of the city. We knew that if we waited one more day, Benghazi, a city nearly the size of Charlotte, could suffer a massacre that would have reverberated across the region and stained the conscience of the world. It was not in our national interest to let that happen. I refused to let that happen. And so 9 days ago, after consulting the bipartisan leadership of Congress, I authorized military action to stop the killing and enforce UN Security Council Resolution 1973.
And then this is President Obama talking about his broad support for the pro-democracy movements in North Africa and the Middle East.
I believe that this movement of change cannot be turned back, and that we must stand alongside those who believe in the same core principles that have guided us through many storms. Our opposition to violence directed at one's own people. Our support for a set of universal rights, including the freedom for people to express themselves and choose their leaders. Our support for governments that are ultimately responsive to the aspirations of the people. Born as we are, out of a revolution by those who longed to be free, we welcome the fact that history is on the move in the Middle East and North Africa, and that young people are leading the way. Because wherever people long to be free, they will find a friend in the United States.
President Obama last night talking about the justification for intervention in Libya and going beyond. Professor Vijay Prashad of Trinity College, your response.
Well, wherever people would like to be free, unless they live in Bahrain, Yemen, and, you know, for a long time, even in Egypt, until the tide was too strong for the Americans to push it back. You know, the resolutions that the United Nations passed, 1970 was the first resolution, and then 1973, are deeply ambiguous resolutions. They got the support of the Arab League, they got the support tacitly, although they abstained, of the Chinese and the Russians, because they said that there was going to be no attempt at assisting the rebels. There was only going to be the obligation to protect civilians. So the President Obama has been playing a tightrope between we are protecting civilians and we want to get rid of Gaddafi. The second thing, get rid of Gaddafi or give assistance to the rebels, is contrary to the UN Resolution 1973. And it should be borne in mind that as much as he said we will not commit ground troops, the United States has already committed ground forces. These may not be boots on the ground, but they are the AC-130 aircraft and the A-10 aircraft, which are both low-flying ground troops support aircraft. These are not to create a no-fly zone. These are to attack ground troops. So the United States has already taken a position in the middle of a civil war. It has already established that it is, in a sense, the armed wing of the rebels. So in that sense, President Obama not once in his speech mentioned the rebels themselves. Like Juan, he spoke of the people versus Gaddafi. And I think that that might be too restricting or too general, perhaps, of a framework to understand this. Now, I, too, believe that there is a broad swath of opinion against Gaddafi. But I think that what this intervention has done is it's narrowed options. And it's not that two or three people are controlling the entire dynamic, but it is their faction, because they have a very close ties now with the principal military power in operation in Libya. It is because of their close ties to the principal military power that their hand is strengthened against the other people in the rebellion. We have seen this over and over again during the moment of so-called humanitarian intervention, that sometimes the worst elements take over a popular movement because they have the closest links to imperial forces. There is a broad movement, and that broad movement is going to be sidelined. It's very interesting that President Obama never talked about the rebels. He only kept indicating the end game, which is that Gaddafi must go. that itself in contravention to UN Resolution 1973. I found it a very peculiar speech. There was no mention of Bahrain, no mention of the Saudi troops crossing the causeway into Manama, no mention of their quest for freedom.
Juan Cole, your response.
Well, I don't think the situation is comparable to Bahrain. I would like to see the Bahrain monarchy, which is a Sunni monarchy ruling over a Shiite majority, show greater flexibility in meeting popular demands for constitutional revision, for better representation of the Shia in the parliament, for moving the monarchy towards a constitutional monarchy. To compare tiny Bahrain, where there has been some violence against protesters, to Libya, where there was a national popular uprising, and where in Libya thousands are dead, not 20. It's just not on the same scale. And the other thing is, let us be practical. Let us be pragmatic. We are people of the left. We care about the ordinary people. We care about workers. We care about the aspirations of the people. And the United States should certainly be putting pressure on the Bahrain monarchy to accommodate them. And in fact, the U.S. has put pressure on it to the extent that the Saudi government is furious with the United States. I mean, we're saying it's not doing enough. The reactionary forces in the Gulf are angry that we're doing too much. A military intervention in Bahrain is not a practical option, and I cannot see in what way it could even have any hope of success. The Bahraini protesters themselves would object to a direct U.S. or NATO military intervention in Bahrain. In Libya, the people asked for this intervention. They asked for a no-fly zone. And I would be the first to admit that this is going beyond a no-fly zone. There's also a no-drive zone. The British and the French and the American fighter pilots have taken out tank positions and artillery positions that had been used to subdue villages and towns that had gone into opposition. The Gaddafi regime has been rolled back by these attacks. And that's part of what the Western understanding, or the NATO and the Arab League understanding of the UN resolution is that Gaddafi was wrong to roll tanks and artillery against these civilian crowds, and that those have to be withdrawn. And where they're not withdrawn, they'll be attacked.
Let me just put the final question.
I don't agree that the resolution, which is worded somewhat ambiguously, that the spirit of it has so far been violated. And President Obama made it quite clear that the United States doesn't intend to press an invasion of a sort that would overthrow Gaddafi directly.
Let me ask Vijay Prashad, on this issue of Benghazi, that the promised massacre of the people of Benghazi, what should have happened? How would that have been prevented?
Firstly, I'm not convinced that there would have been a massacre. I think that there were troops inside Benghazi. They are the troops that were trained and armed by the Libyan regime. They had repulsed an attempt into Benghazi. The tanks were outside the city when they were bombed by French planes. What I would have liked to have seen was some more action from the Arab League to think about, for instance, a war refugee corridor out of Benghazi into the Egyptian border. There is a road that goes directly. It's interesting that the Egyptian army did not act at all in this to come and create some kind of corridor. There were war refugees fleeing Tripoli into Tunisia, but there was nothing comparable on the eastern side. This had already become a civil war, and no longer was it simply unarmed population fighting against a state. It had become a civil war. The real humanitarian intervention there would have been to have conducted the creation of a corridor, a momentary ceasefire, let people leave as war refugees, and then see what happens. Because this is not strictly the case in Benghazi of unarmed civilians fighting against a state. It is precisely why General Ham of the African Command said that from a cockpit, it is very hard to know whether you're defending civilians or whether you're assisting rebels.
We're going to have to leave it.
In the briefing room, we were able to tell it was rebels. but really it was also civilians.
Vijay Prashad, Juan Cole, we will leave it there, but the debate goes on. Juan Cole, professor at the University of Michigan, blogs it at Forum Comment and juancole.com, most recent book, Engaging the Muslim World. Vijay Prashad, chair in South Asian History and professor of international studies at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut, his latest book, The Darker Nations, A People's History of the Third World. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we will find out about an Egyptian-American who's being detained by Syrian forces, and we'll look at the case of Troy Davis. The Supreme Court has denied his appeal. Stay with us.
Down in old Savannah, shots rang through the night. A man's last pistol whipped in the corner. A cop crumbles in a streaking light. Jumping Jehoshaphat, where are you gonna turn? The system has done failed you, and it'll fail the next hangburn. Well, I'm asking, is a true day in court after 19 years on the death row bed? 7 or 9 say they gave false witness at the time, but the judge, he still want me dead. Cause there was no physical weapon, no.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we turn to Syria, where state forces continue a brutal crackdown. On Monday, Syrian forces fired tear gas, live ammunition into a crowd of hundreds in the town of Dara. More than 60 people have died since protests erupted there 10 days ago. The demonstrations have also spread to Latakia and Hama. According to some estimates, over 280 people have been arrested. The detained include Egyptian-American engineer named Mohammed Radwan. Syrian state television has aired what it called a confession by Radwan, in which he says he visited Israel in secret and took money in exchange for providing photographs and video about Syria. Radwan's family says the statement's false and must have resulted from coercion. Democracy Now!'s Sherif Abdelkadou spoke to Radwan back on February 1st when he was in Egypt participating in the first day of the First Million People March on Cairo's Tahrir Square. This is Mohammed Radwan.
Mohammed Radwan. My family is from Cairo, Egypt. I've been living abroad for many years, and now I'm living in Damascus, Syria. And I got here Friday morning. I woke up, read the news, and I realized Friday there's going to be a lot of wool activity, and I don't want to miss out on that. So I went and got a ticket, and I got here Friday morning and to join the events of Friday afternoon. I lived in the States, and, you know, there's a lot of political awareness since 2001 or 2002 when wars started and everything. Back then, before pre-2001, there wasn't too much thought about the political anyone's political identity. Well, here people are always politically aware. They always have a political opinion, but everyone was so jaded. And seeing this, all of a sudden, everyone is politically charged. Everyone's got an opinion. Everyone wants to see change.
That was Mohammed Radwan speaking in Tahrir Square to Democracy Now!'s Sherif Abdelkadous. Now, Mohammed Radwan's father has traveled to Syria in a bid to win his son's release. There's no word he'll be set free. We're joined in Washington by Mohammed's brother, Tarek. Welcome to Democracy Now! Tell us the latest that you know about your brother.
Thank you for having me, Amy. Yes, my father has traveled to Syria. He's been there since the day before yesterday, and he's been meeting with government officials from both the U.S. side and the Egyptian side. He's met with the Egyptian ambassador and some of his staff. They have sent requests, formal requests, to the Syrian authorities requesting information, whereabouts, charges, if any, that are lodged against Mohammed. But so far, none of those requests have been answered. When he went to go visit the United States Embassy in Damascus, he was stopped by Syrian secret police, and they asked him to go with them if he wanted to know any information about Mohammed. weighing the risks, he decided to go, and they seated him down and asked him to write a formal petition that included a brief life summary and the circumstances on how Muhammad ended up in Damascus. Unfortunately, after that, after he finished writing that petition, there was no information given to him, and they refused to give his whereabouts.
Your dad has a business there. That's what Mohammed Radwan was doing in Syria?
That's correct. My brother's been working for my father's company as an engineer and office manager in Syria for over 9 months now.
This is an excerpt of your brother Mohammed's so-called confession that was aired on Syrian state television.
There were people from the outside the country who corresponded with me and asked me about the situation. So one day I received an email and it said, "Are you prepared to help someone who speaks Spanish?"
Can you explain what that was, Tarek?
Sure. My brother, he's an avid traveler. He's traveled extensively throughout South America, and it's not unusual that he would make friends there. If he was indeed in contact with someone from there, it's no surprise. I understand that the so-called confession was about selling pictures to this person. My brother, as you saw, is a very politically conscious person, and I don't think that he would take any money if someone requested pictures of what was happening. But he's also been very conscious to remain neutral about what's been going on in Syria. He knows he's not Syrian. He knows this is a Syrian struggle that they have to sort out for themselves. And he also doesn't want to jeopardize my father's business in Damascus.
He went to Tahrir Square in Egypt, though, to participate. Is that right? He's Egyptian-American. You're Egyptian-American.
That is correct. We were both born in the U.S. Our family is Egyptian, and we traveled back there frequently. And as part Egyptian identity, we felt very strongly about what was happening in Egypt, and I wish I had gone. However, the Syrian situation is quite different.
So what are you calling for right now? I know there's organizing going on in Egypt. Your dad is in Syria. What do you need to happen now, and what is the U.S. doing?
Well, the U.S. has been actually very, very helpful, very supportive in sending out formal requests to the Syrian authorities. But as of yet, he remains in incommunicado detention. And the Syrians are refusing to work with the Americans despite their efforts. And they said that they would be in touch through the Egyptian Foreign Ministry. However, as of yet, there remains no information. My father will continue pushing the diplomatic side in Syria, while my mother in Egypt hopefully will try and get the Arab League on board to push for his release. I know my cousins are working very strong through social media, galvanizing support. They're organizing a protest outside of the Syrian embassy in Cairo on Wednesday. And here in D.C., I will attempt to meet with the Syrian ambassador. I've already reached out to former colleagues at Human Rights Watch. Friends have reached out to Amnesty International. And we're also going through trying to contact other international organizations to increase the pressure, increase the political cost to the Syrians for holding him.
Tarek Radwan, thanks very much for being with us, and we will continue to track what happens to your brother, Mohammed Radwan, now in custody by in Syrian forces. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, as we turn now to our last segment. On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court refused to hear the appeal of the well-known Georgia death row prisoner Troy Anthony Davis, likely setting the stage for Georgia to schedule his execution. Troy Davis was convicted in 1989 of killing an off-duty white police officer, Mark McPhail. Since then, 7 of the 9 non-police witnesses who fingered Davis have recanted their testimony. There's no physical evidence that ties Davis to the crime scene. His case has garnered widespread national and international support from figures like Pope Benedict, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, all calling for clemency in his case. John Lewis, the congressman from Georgia, has also weighed in. With his legal appeals exhausted, the fate of Troy Davis rests largely in the hands of Georgia's Board of Pardons and Parole, which could commute his death sentence and spare his life. Earlier this month, federal regulators seized Georgia's entire stockpile of sodium thiopental, a sedative used to carry out lethal injections. This means even if the state sets a date for Troy Davis's execution, it can't carry it out until the Drug Enforcement Administration concludes its investigation or Georgia switches to another drug. For more on these developments, I'm joined now by Troy Davis's older sister, his staunchest defender, Martina Correa. She's an anti-death penalty activist. She's in Savannah, Georgia. She's joining us on the Democracy Now! Video stream from her home. Martina, welcome to Democracy Now! Talk about this latest development, enormous setback for Troy, the Supreme Court refusing to hear his case.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for having me. We were really shocked and appalled yesterday when we received the news that the U.S. Supreme Court had denied Troy's petition for a new trial and denied the petition to ask the lower courts to at least look at the new evidence. And so, you know, it was a total setback and shock to the attorneys as well, because when the U.S. Supreme Court deemed in June of 2010 that the lower courts in Savannah should listen to the new evidence, they let one judge decide whether or not he felt he believed the new evidence enough to give Troy a new trial. And, you know, what this did was it set the stage, because they brought Troy back to the same community, same court system, same prosecutor that actually had convicted him initially. And so when you walked into the courtroom, the judge had the demeanor that no matter what Troy's lawyers had to present, no matter what the witnesses had to say, he already had predisposed decision about denying Troy. And then when he sent that information to the U.S. Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, of course, the court has changed its dynamic a little bit, has refused to hear the case because everyone just keeps passing this. And no one wants to look at the actual innocence, and no one wants to look at the witness recantation as a real strong and viable part of this case. Even though new witnesses have come forward, they were actually criminalized in the hearing in June and made to feel ostracized by coming forward. And it was really amazing because the police officer that testified at the hearing could not remember anything about the case, and they actually had selective amnesia. So the judge said that he would believe the police officers over recanted testimony of any witnesses. So it didn't matter what we had to say or what we had to do. The judge had already predisposed himself against Troy. And so when we went back to the U.S. Supreme Court, we were hoping that they would give us some relief because the judge did not even follow directions given by the court. But the court again decided that it doesn't want to handle the case and it just wants to pass the buck. So they did not deem to hear the case nor ask the lower courts to hear the case.
Martina, what was the most compelling new evidence that you felt needed to be heard?
Well, there were three new witnesses who had heard Sylvester Red Coles, the other person involved in the case, who he had confessed to, and that he had been bragging about killing the police officer. And two of these people had no criminal history. And, you know, the judge, when they got up on the stand, the judge was like, you know, if you're another witness going to get up here and say Sylvester Coles did it, you know, if Sylvester Coles is not here, how can we, you know, take your word over his? So, you know, one person had come from the hospital having surgery just to testify. And her voice was a little low because she had surgery on her throat. And the judge was like, if you can't speak louder, we're not going to listen to your testimony. And she was like, I just got out of the hospital. This is the loudest I can speak. Of course, we could hear her. But, you know, it was like the judge didn't want to hear anything anybody had to say. And a lot of people—
Martina, we have 10 seconds. What do you think needs to be done right now?
I think there needs to be a global mobilization about Troy's case, and the fact that in the United States it's not unconstitutional to execute an innocent person needs to be addressed once and for all by the U.S. Supreme Court. And I think that we should get as many people involved, pro and non-death penalty people, to stand up and say, this is not why we support the death penalty. Killing innocent people does not bring justice to either family.
People can go to our website at democracynow.org for the whole archive of coverage of Troy Davis's case. Martina Correa, thanks for joining us. I'm Amy Goodman.